You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. We'll hear from Bill and Melinda Gates this hour. They spoke to John Hockenberry this week. They've taken a new direction for their foundation's annual letter, and it's all about exploding some of the myths surrounding poverty. You're already part of that conversation. We asked you, what parts of the world do you think need foreign aid and why? From Massachusetts, this text about foreign aid says, honestly, none. The whole point of foreign aid is the same as welfare. You help people and countries get back on their feet. We as a country are not able to support the world in its endeavor to better itself. That comes from within itself.
My name is Colin Cole from Seattle, Washington. We shouldn't look at geography as much as we should consider class. The impoverished in totality need to be lifted up if we truly wish to make the world a better place.
Thanks for that, Colin. Shay from Massachusetts thinks we need to target poverty in a much more strategic way.
Shay Green, I'm calling from Wareham, Massachusetts, and any part of the world that does not use birth control, because they need to be educated.
Shay, that's an idea you'll hear Bill and Melinda Gates talk about later, and we have more on what they think we get right about helping the poor and what we get wrong. That's all at thetakeaway.org. Also today, some myth-making or mischief-making in the camp of New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. WNYC reporter Matt Katz will be here to help us separate fact from fiction. But we'll start with Syria and the efforts to keep the Geneva II peace conference alive. Talks start tomorrow, and for the first time in the nearly three-year-old conflict, it's anticipated that the UN-backed talks will bring together representatives from both sides of the fighting.
I especially appeal to the Syrian parties themselves to keep one goal in mind: the end of the suffering of the Syrian people and the beginning of a transition to a new Syria.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon at a news conference over the weekend. He had to backtrack on a plan to invite Iran to the peace talks. The Syrian National Coalition threatened to pull out, and Secretary of State John Kerry was apparently furious at the invitation. Ultimately, Ban Ki-moon rescinded that invitation, and the talks are back on. Joining us now to explain the significance of the latest developments surrounding the talks is Mona Yacoubian, senior advisor to the Stimson Center's Middle East program. Mona, hi.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm very well. Welcome back to The Takeaway. We'll get to the prospects for a success in these talks in a minute because they seem dim, but let's take a step back to begin. Ban Ki-moon of the United Nations must have known that the United States and opposition forces in Syria would consider backing away from the talks if he invited Iran, but he did it anyway.
Yeah, it's, you know, yesterday's brinksmanship and high drama, I think people are still trying to unravel a bit what was going on behind the scenes. UN Secretary General Ban did say that he was under the impression he had received an endorsement by Iran of the key points of the Geneva communique. And so it was on that basis that he went ahead and issued this. It's obviously clear that Iran did not make that promise, or there was some miscommunication, and that's what led to yesterday's drama.
At the same time, if peace talks are going to yield any real peace, one wonders if it's possible without Iran. They control Hezbollah, which is pouring fighters into Syria on behalf of Bashar al-Assad, not to mention other levers that Iran pulls in the region on a regular basis. Is there any real hope without Iran at the table?
I don't think so. I actually think Iran plays a key role. They are, as you note, a key supporter of Hezbollah. They are perhaps the staunchest ally of the Assad regime, which is, of course, the reason that the Syrian opposition, the U.S. and others are saying they shouldn't be at the table unless they endorse the notion that this conference is about transition in Syria. But that said, Iran is a key regional power broker. If they don't participate, they can be a very effective spoiler. And so, yes, I think prospects without Iranian participation are dim.
It's also very tenuous, as I understand it. A lot of the factions in the opposition don't want these talks to go on. They don't want their people involved. And in fact, they're not even releasing the names of some of their negotiators.
Yes. No, the Syrian opposition is deeply divided over this issue and many others. And in fact, fighters on the ground are very much opposed to the Geneva talks. and have even talked about putting out a kill list for those who participate. So there are security concerns for those negotiators. But I think more broadly, there's a very valid question about how much influence will they have, and will they really be in a position to negotiate on behalf of those fighting on the ground? And I think the answer is largely no.
Mona Yacoubian, one of the arguments of people pushing a nuclear deal with Iran, which has just gone into effect this week, was that it would build bridges and build goodwill for things like Syria on this very issue. And yet we get to the talks where, sorry for the cliche, but the rubber meets the road, and it's not time for that goodwill. The nuclear talks haven't led to enough of a relationship, a working relationship with Iran yet. Some people thought those two things might be connected.
Well, I still think they could be, although I think what's happened over the last day or so is a very auspicious point in terms of U.S.-Iranian relations as well. I mean, in some ways, had Iran been able to participate in these talks, it would have been a very important test of whether or not Iran can indeed play a constructive role in the region. Now we have Iran essentially very angry at the fact that this invitation has been rescinded. And I think any notion of confidence building and bridge building at this time is going to be on the back burner, unfortunately.
Well, let's talk about expectations then, as these factionated sides try to talk to each other. It's been a bloody civil war for 3 years. A lot of the reporting leading up to these talks has senior American officials in the press basically saying, don't expect much and don't expect it very soon. Usually, at least with peace talks, there's a lot of cheerleading going in and momentum building. Nobody seems to be under any illusions.
No, I mean, I think this is an exercise in setting expectations. I think it's been clear for a long time that these talks right now are not going to yield any immediate success. Secretary Kerry himself is talking about this is going to be a long and arduous process. And I think actually what happened yesterday underscores the fragility of these talks and the fact that, unfortunately, because of the conditions on the ground, because of the complexity of Syria's conflict, it's very difficult at this point to expect any sort of success coming out of this current round.
And yet there are hopes for maybe some small advances, some local ceasefires or some humanitarian aid getting through to a couple towns. That's sort of the bar they've set, as I understand it.
Yes, and I think that those issues are actually very important. I mean, if we think about the level of suffering inside Syria, it's essential, I think, to put humanitarian access and some sort of de-escalation of the conflict front and center. And with any hope, there may in fact be negotiations that will allow for some more humanitarian aid to reach the many Syrians that are trapped, and there may be some localized ceasefires that are negotiated.
And what do these talks look like inside the room? We're sort of used to some talks where, you know, opposition forces sit in one wing of the hotel and Assad representatives in another wing and Russians and Americans shuttle back and forth. Is it like that, or is everybody in one big room kind of yelling at each other? What's the layout here?
My guess is it's going to be more the former. And let's remember, what happens tomorrow in Montreux is a larger set of talks, or an opening plenary, if you will, that includes not only the Syrian protagonists, but some 30 different nation states. Then 2 days later, they will reconvene in a much smaller setting in Geneva. And my guess is that they will likely be proximity talks. That is, that the UN and Russia and the U.S. will be playing a shuttling role in between the two Syrian protagonists. I don't imagine that they would be in the same room.
And Mona Yacoubian, if I were one of the negotiators, and I'm not, I don't know about you, I might consider setting up a very quiet back channel to Iran while this whole thing is going on, if you want it to really mean much.
I think that's going to be essential. I mean, I think at some point Iran is going to need to be brought into this. They really do play a critical role. And it may be that once the bright lights are off and this settles into what, by all accounts, is going to be a long process, Iran as a key player in the region will be brought into the discussions.
Mona Yacoubian is senior advisor for the Stimson Center's Middle East program, joins us frequently to talk about Syria. Mona, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Still to come on the program, we'll speak to the man behind some words that have a lot of people talking, and they're these. In my last year on Wall Street, my bonus was $3.6 million, and I was angry because it wasn't big enough. I was 30 years old, had no children to raise, no debts to pay, no philanthropic goal in mind. I wanted more money for exactly the same reason an alcoholic needs another drink. I was addicted. Those are the words of former hedge fund manager Sam Polk, and he's going to join us with his thoughts about learning the limits of wealth. And we'll move past what you could call the rich and greedy to bust a few myths about how we help the poor. We'll hear from Bill and Melinda Gates on the steps needed to make poverty history, something that starts with challenging the ideas we have about how to make a dent in huge pockets of poverty around the world.
You know, I saw the innovation and the opportunities that both Melinda and I had, and I thought, wow, this is a fantastic thing. Then as we traveled the world, we saw that things weren't as good in poor countries. And so the question arose, was that changing or, you know, were they continuing to fall behind? So it's been a learning process to see that, wow, even though they're still behind, they're not nearly as far behind as they were in the past. And there's ways of creating even a level of equity, whether it's income or health type outcomes. It's very unfortunate that people don't see this progress because then the generosity they provide, they don't feel good about, and they don't see the need to learn and double down.
Well, here's the core problem. I mean, that can look really, really good in a nice PowerPoint graphic, those numbers, but it's really about how people feel. And if they don't feel as though things are getting better, then you have the kind of instability in Africa that you have in the Central African Republic and in a lot of places that seem to be immune to sustainable change because of political problems, all about feeling better as opposed to looking at the numbers.
Well, in Africa, there's no confusion that things have gotten better over the last 40 years. It's more in the United States looking at poor countries and saying, is this a static picture or have we made dramatic progress? You know, they have many of the fastest growing economies in the world. As you go up the income ladder, the ability to build stable governments and get the investment in education right, that's always an uncertain process. But we know that as you do get richer, stability, rights, all the things that we care about come into play. And so you start with health, you get the economics right, and eventually there's a level of human dignity that we think of as universal.
We have more from that interview with Bill and Melinda Gates later this hour here on The Takeaway. And we've been asking you where you think foreign aid should go to help bring communities out of poverty. This listener from Oklahoma City says, foreign aid, it needs to stop going to any country from America. The world hates us no matter how much we give in aid. We are broke financially. China and Russia have the financial power now. Let them give the foreign aid. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and be part of this conversation. Find us, too, on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Well, Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey is being sworn in for his second term as governor today. And let's assume that getting sworn in is probably the easiest thing on his to-do list today. That's because he is amid a scandal over traffic jams on the world's busiest bridge and a controversy over aid for Superstorm Sandy that was supposed to go to some places in his state. Already, the scandal's taken a toll on the governor's image. A recent national poll by the Pew Research Center and USA Today found that the unfavorable views of Chris Christie have doubled since January. Why does that matter for the governor of New Jersey? Because a lot of Republicans want him to run for the nomination for president, of course. Joining us is Matt Katz, reporter for our partner WNYC, who's been all over this story. Hi, Matt.
Hi there, Todd.
Thanks for joining us. Matt, let's start with the issue of the Sandy aid that some people, that Mayor Dawn Zimmer of Hoboken says was held hostage when she didn't do the right thing by the governor. Let's listen to this cut from Hoboken Mayor Dawn Zimmer.
The lieutenant governor came to Hoboken. She pulled me aside in the parking lot and she said, I know it's not right. I know these things should not be connected, but they are. And if you tell anyone, I'll deny it.
That was from MSNBC, and then here's the denial from the Lieutenant Governor, Kim Guadagno.
Mayor Zimmer's version of our conversation in May of 2013 is not only false, but is illogical.
Matt Katz, what do we make of all this?
I mean, this is a significant accusation. Unlike the bridge scandal that Christie has been embroiled in for the last couple of weeks, which involves political retribution, accusations of political retribution against an official who didn't support him. There is no smoking gun in this case. I mean, we don't have any document that indicates a close Christie aide threatened to take away Sandy money if the mayor didn't support a certain project. We just have the mayor saying it. But the actual accusation is more significant than the bridge scandal. And that's because Sandy and the recovery from that superstorm has been Christie's greatest political strength. This is what he rode to re-election on. People loved the way he handled the storm immediately thereafter. Also, there are still thousands of New Jerseyans suffering in the aftermath of the storm. There's still thousands of people not back in their homes. This is a deep wound that still exists in the state, psychologically, too. I mean, it only happened 14 months ago. As far as New Jerseyans are concerned, you don't mess with Sandy aid, particularly money they fought so hard to get. So if the revelations indicate that if there's any further truth to them, then it could be a major problem for him.
Do you think it's the case, Matt Katz, you just sort of hit on it there, that people might brush aside a state official, a governor, intimidating a mayor somewhere saying, you don't get your project money unless you come with me? That might just be a little bit of, throwing elbows in politics. But with Sandy aid, it's different. You don't mess with it.
Absolutely. And if you remember, there was a big issue where some of the Tea Party representatives in Congress were not willing to send the money as immediately as Christie wanted. And he had to actually call out his fellow Republicans, the Speaker of the House, for holding up the money. So, I mean, New Jerseyans, fronted by their governor, fought so hard for this money. It's also a problem for Christie politically long term, because if he was seen as messing with federal funds, you could see some conservatives in a Republican presidential primary, for example, accusing him of wasting government resources. So on two fronts, it's a problem.
At the same time, you mentioned no smoking gun, and there is a risk here that those of us in the media keep talking about this story, which is a claim from one Hoboken mayor. You need to have documents. You need to have emails, or else this is going to affect Christie in a way that may not be fair.
Sure. And she has emails indicating that she wanted more money than they gave her. And she has also emails indicating that they wanted this redevelopment project, or at least people in his administration wanted this redevelopment project. But she has yet to connect the two. And it's interesting. I mean, if this hadn't come on the heels of the so-called Bridgegate scandal, this would not be getting the attention it has. But there, because of that scandal, it also lends some credence in the eyes of the public and some in the media that there's some legitimacy to this, because now we have this narrative that Christie is the type of guy who will seek revenge and bully politicians to do what he says. But in this case, we don't actually have the proof just yet.
You even have a former American track star Olympic gold medalist Carl Lewis running around saying Christie tried to intimidate him when he wanted to run for state senate and tried to push him out of the race. But Matt Katz of WNYC, before we let you go here, some people have tried to interpret a couple of Christie's recent comments in the wake of the bridge scandal especially to suggest that he might be backing off his desire to be president. Is that too fine an interpretation? Do we have any indication of his real intentions at this point?
No, I mean he doesn't want to begin running for president now for several reasons. And he told some donors over the weekend, talk to me next year. I mean, he's now the chairman of the Republican Governors Association for the next year, and that was always considered a stepping stone toward a possible run. So I think as long as no other major shoe drops, the plan within the Christie camp is still to try to prepare for a presidential run in 2016. I don't think that's changed. The best thing the governor is going for him right now is this scandal broke with more than 700 days until the Iowa caucuses.
That's
so
right.
He's got that going for him.
A lot of corners to turn, a lot of places to go before this actually comes down to a place where it could really affect Chris Christie in Iowa and beyond. That's for sure. That is Matt Katz from our partner WNYC, who's been all over the Chris Christie story. Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
According to today's Financial Times, Ukraine is living through its most dangerous period since its independence more than two decades ago. Pitched battles continue to play out on the streets of the capital, Kiev, with parts of the city looking more like a war zone. The latest round of clashes are thought to be in part in response to tough new laws recently enacted that restrict the right to protest. As we speak, a solution to the political crisis gripping the country looks further away than ever. Zenon Zawada has been reporting on Ukraine for the best part of a decade, and he joins me now from Kiev. Zenon, what's the latest from the streets? What's happening?
Well, the worst violence of the Euromaidan occurred this weekend. And now we have a situation where the Maidan protest is in a crisis. And there's parts that want to keep it at a nonviolent level, and there's others that are saying that there's going to be a government crackdown, and the only way to respond is with violence.
It would seem, at the very least, that this anti-protest legislation seems to have backfired. Is this the very reason that people are on the streets, or is it incidental?
It's the reason why people turned violent. For most of the protest, it was nonviolent. And when the government restricted basic rights, such as gathering in groups, wearing helmets and masks, traveling in groups of cars more than five, that's when people decided that the government is not responding to their nonviolent pleas.
And Zenon, what are these protests about in the first place? We understand that the anti-protest laws may have provoked some of the violence, or at least been connected to it. But what was the grievance in the first place that led the government to say you can't protest at all?
Well, this all began when Ukrainian President Yanukovych was balancing Russian and European integration against each other for many months. And in August, he indicated that Ukraine would take a European integration course. And as many of your listeners know, Ukraine lies right in the middle between Russia and Europe. But at the last minute, in late November, he announced that Ukraine would not be pursuing Euro integration at this moment. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back, so to speak. That's where people not only protested against not signing the association agreement, but they were protesting against 3 years of authoritarian abuses of the Yanukovych administration. It was tension that was building up over 3 years that exploded. And when the government beat peaceful protesters in the early days of the protest, that just fueled more people to join, to the point where there's millions supporting this movement.
And so where does this likely go next? The world's eyes are about to turn to Sochi in Russia. Of course, Russia stands firmly behind the government of Ukraine, and I can't imagine that either President Yanukovych nor President Putin in Russia want a violent flare-up right before the games start here.
It's important to make a distinction that Ukraine is a very different country than Russia. Although they were united for many decades under the Soviet Union, these are two distinct cultures with two distinct histories and citizenry. And Ukrainians are much more European-oriented. They believe in rule of law, equality before the law, and these are Western values that millions of Ukrainians support. And Yanukovych won't be able to handle the protests as Putin has in his country. He faces an enormous opposition, and this conflict is not going away anytime soon. It will get violent, bloody, but it will continue for many months to come.
Protests continuing in Kiev, some of them violent. Zenon Zawada reporting for us from Ukraine. Zenon, thank you.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away.
Well, no sooner did we get out from under the polar vortex than another round of frigid weather is sweeping across the nation from Denver to Atlanta. While most meteorologists focus on weather patterns, we also know that the sun's behavior plays a role in regulating winter temperatures. It's through what's known as the solar cycle. And what's remarkable about the solar cycle right now is how quiet it is. The word sleepy has been used to describe the sun right now. So sleepy, in fact, it hasn't been this quiet in about 100 years. David Hathaway is solar astronomer at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center and joins me now. Hi, David.
Hello, Todd.
Well, how do we know that the sun is actually sleepy? I mean, it seems to be anything but.
It's pretty simple. We count sunspots. Sunspots are dark, cooler regions on the surface of the sun where intense magnetic fields loop up from the sun's interior, and we've been observing them for 400 years now, since Galileo first used his telescope. And we can count sunspots, and we see that they go through this 11-year cycle of no sunspots to 100, 200 on the sun on a day, back to none again. And we are now in, at the maximum of a sunspot cycle, but it's the smallest sunspot cycle in 100 years.
And the last time this happened, people actually noticed that it affected the weather here on Earth. Is it too soon to tell whether this sleepy cycle is actually making it colder? Does it happen that fast?
It takes a long time to see it. Again, it's actually a fairly small effect. And what the sun does, it's actually brighter when there are more sunspots by about a tenth of a percent. And it's somewhat darker when there aren't any sunspots. But that tenth of a percent corresponds to about a tenth of a degree centigrade, so two-tenths of a degree Fahrenheit. It's a pretty small effect.
So the Earth's climate, because of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, is warming. There may be a counter trend because of a sleepy sun cycle that it's actually cooling a tiny bit. And I read that, and it made me think a lot of people are going to misconstrue a cold winter or a couple of icy days or a, frozen northern Europe or something and say, see, this global warming isn't really happening at all. And that might be a little misleading.
You have to separate weather and climate. Climate are long-term averages. In fact, right now, if you ask the Australians what it was like, they'd tell you, in fact, it's very hot right now. But again, that's weather. Climate are decade-long averages of temperatures. And so we can't really go by the fact that it's cold outside right now and say, well, there, it's cooling, not warming.
Is there an advantage to this sleepy peak in the sun cycle? I mean, I remember hearing as a kid that fewer sunspots means better radio reception, maybe cell phones work better, communications. What are the effects in other parts of life here?
There are those aspects that when the sun is quite active, it can disrupt radio communications. For the climate end of things, the sun did go through a period back in the 1600s of no sunspots at all for 70 years. Basically, the sunspot cycle stopped for 70 years. We call it the Maunder minimum. And there is some suspicion among my colleagues that we may be heading into another one of those. And the good part of it is you'd have less disruption of radio communications. The satellites stay in orbit longer. When the sun is very active, the Earth's atmosphere heats up and expands. So satellites like the space station, in fact, experience drag that can make their orbits spiral in, and that is lessened if the sun is less active. So there may be good things about it like that. Scientifically, of course, the big thing for us is we weren't around in the 1600s to see exactly how the sun did it and how it came out of it. And so as scientists, we're interested in exactly how the sun does this.
If you were a tourist about to head to Alaska to see the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights, you might want to put it off. It might not be your year. You might want to wait till the next peak in the sun cycle. That's David Hathaway, solar astronomer at NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center. David, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Later this hour, we're talking to Bill and Melinda Gates. Now, Bill Gates is in the 85 top wealthiest people in the world, a group whose wealth in total is half the net worth of the entire globe. Now, wealth can be a tool for investment, for development, for change, of course. And we'll be hearing about how the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is trying to spread the wealth and fix the problems of global poverty. But wealth can also be an end in itself, a status symbol, a way of wielding power, and an addiction. And that was the case for my next guest. In his last year on Wall Street, Sam Polk, who is a hedge fund trader at the time, made $3.6 million in bonuses. But he says in an article in the New York Times, it just wasn't enough. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
A true addiction. Some people might say, geez, I don't know, alcohol, pills, drugs, of course. Money, a real addiction. Everybody needs it. Everybody strives for it.
Addiction is a really interesting paradigm to look at wealth from. And what I mean by that is that, you know, it is a sickness, this thing that's going on in our culture where, you know, the people at the top feel like they don't have enough. And these people keep accumulating more and more. And I was definitely one of those people. And the reason I came out with that story is I said, look, you know, there's something going on in our culture where people at the top feel like they don't have enough and people at the bottom actually don't have enough. And when you look at, you know, sort of this rising inequality as a function of sickness, then it actually becomes a more interesting thing to look at because people look at Wall Street with a lot of anger, right? They look at these guys at the top, Wolf of Wall Street type guys, and say, like, these guys are consumed with greed and I'm going to judge them and they're evil. But if you actually shift that a little bit and you start thinking about these guys at the top as spiritually sick and having something, having this feeling that they don't have enough and that they're constantly trying to fill that hole inside them, then actually it makes them both a little bit more human, but it also makes it a little scarier because it means that they're not just bad people, but that they're not going to change. There's not going to be an awakening until, you know, I don't know if you have any experience dealing with addiction, but it's not something that just changes overnight. You actually have to hit bottom. You actually have to have some consequences. And the idea that wealth is an addiction is a really scary one because we actually exist in a culture where there's no consequences. We live in a culture that promotes this wealth addiction. And actually, the bigger that addiction gets, the more adulation, the more support, the more TV articles, the more radio interviews people get. And that's really the scary thing because, you know, because pretty much we're existing in a world right now where people at the bottom don't have enough and wages for the last 30 years haven't gone up at all. And still the people at the top feel like they don't have enough. And I think we're reaching this point where, you know, the world is scared because this kind of, you know, continually rising inequality can't continue to exist.
Well, one of the things that you talk about, though, Sam, in terms of this addiction sort of flies in the face of what's supposed to be driving our capitalist system. Sure, if one person just can't stop, we can say that's like a cocaine addiction or alcoholism or some other kind of addiction. But wanting more, striving for more, getting more is supposed to be what drives the entire American ethos.
Yeah, you know, that's true. And I think that there is some, like, I do want to say that I think that, you know, money can be a really great thing. And, you know, wanting to support your family can be a great thing. But I think it's also a question about balance. I mean, we are in the American dream is, you know, ideally a place that you can arrive at, that you can have it made. And then the idea with the American dream is that once you have it made, then you can kind of look down at the people below you that have less than you. But that doesn't happen in our current society. Everybody continues. And at least this was true on Wall Street. You know, I was sitting with guys that were making, you know, $3, $4, $5 million, and they were looking at their bosses making $20 million, and they weren't looking. And by the way, I include myself in this. They weren't looking at the people below them who maybe were making $25,000 or $30,000. And so while this idea of the American dream is really important, I also think this idea of a connected America is really important, where people feel responsibility for the people that have less than them. And, you know, one of the most interesting things about my article is, you know, there's been this massive kind of outpouring of support, and a ton of it has come from college kids, you know, and these college kids are like reading my article and they say, you know, I don't know what to do because on one hand, I'm about to graduate from Dartmouth or Yale and I have a chance to go on to Wall Street and I don't want to give that up. But on the other hand, I want to do something good for the world. And I think the structure of our system where we're only benefiting We're really encouraging these people to kind of go out for themselves on a purely selfish basis so that they can get more and more is scary, you know? And I think that there is like, you know, I almost think sometimes like the people on Wall Street, but also in general America is like, you know, have you ever seen people in like bodybuilding competitions, these huge Sure. guys with all these muscles and they're working out 10 hours a day so that they can just get another 5 pounds. Well, that's what Wall Street is like, right? These guys have it made. I had it made. But they're not, then once you have it made, there needs to be this idea where you look around at the people below you and say, hey, you know, I have a responsibility to these people. Like, you know, some of the people that I work with in grocery ships, these are families, low-income families struggling.
Now, let me stop you there because Grocery Ship is the nonprofit that you started. And just real quick before we go, tell us what it does.
Yeah, it's a program for low-income families that are struggling with obesity. So it's a program, a six-month program where people apply, and then we not only give them money where they can buy purely healthy food, fruits, vegetables, grains, and beans, but then we also work with them for 6 months to teach them skills that they can use to navigate a really difficult food environment. And then even more important than that, we surround them with other families who are struggling so that they have a support group for dealing with the idea of like food and obesity and food addiction in a culture that clearly promotes obesity and food addiction.
Sam Polk is a former hedge fund trader and founder of the nonprofit Grocery Ship who gave up the addiction of wealth. Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, we've been asking you, wealth, if you have it, where would you send financial aid? Aid should be sent to Syrian refugees in East and Central Africa, says one person on Facebook. We want your take at 8778-MY-TAKE. That's our number. And there's much more at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you. We've spent some time this hour on the conflicts in Ukraine and Syria, and even some right here at home. The question of how and when to intervene in other countries is one with which we in the West often struggle. Now we turn to two people who have spent much of their time considering that question on a truly global scale. Bill and Melinda Gates have just released a letter laying out their philanthropic goals for developing nations around the world. They focused on some of the myths that they believe create roadblocks to pulling people out of poverty and into the middle class. John Hockenberry spoke with Bill and Melinda Gates about the most effective ways to support growth and development around the world.
Bill and Melinda Gates, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
Great to be here.
Thanks.
So what is the message that you really want people to get from this annual message, which really is less about the foundation and much more about a certain exasperation with the way the conditions you're trying to change in the world are actually getting better? Bill?
Well, there's some key beliefs that underlie the work we do. And these are things we wouldn't have known ourselves unless we were deeply engaged. In fact, the way the news talks about setbacks, it'd be easy to be confused. So we focus the letter on what the myths are and why they're wrong.
Can we take the last one first? Melinda, it's scientifically interesting as to why improving health conditions actually has a positive impact on birth rate. What have you discovered?
Well, what we discover is that as more children survive in a family around the world, parents naturally want to bring down their birth rate because they want to be able to feed and educate those children, and they see the future for their children. It happened in France in the late 1700s, Germany in the mid-1800s. Then it happened in Argentina, Brazil, lately Bangladesh, Syria. So you see the trend across the world, and you start to see where people have been left behind, and that is Africa, where 200 million women say they'd like to have access to contraceptives but still don't.
Do people actually tell you, what are you talking about here? Saving lives increases the population and makes things worse.
Well, people do believe that. And I think even before we got into this work, we started to say, my goodness, if all these children survive, what is going to happen to the planet? Because I think a lot of things that had been written in the late 1960s about the population explosion, those myths have held. And so as we've learned more about this and realized, my goodness, the opposite is true, we want to make sure the word gets out there.
Let's take the second myth that you talk about. Bill, there's always criticism of foreign aid, particularly in the United States. It's not a huge expenditure on the part of U.S. governments. And you try to explode this idea that aid produces dependence. There are certain forms of aid that do create dependence by developing nations, yes?
Well, every intervention you do, you've got to make sure it's got positive effects. Giving people better seeds raises their agricultural productivity. Making sure their kids are healthy allows them to have economic output themselves. If you went in and ran businesses yourself or distorted prices, yes, that could mix things up. And you do want to work with them to make sure you're not flying in too many experts, that you're educating their people. And so aid is something we need to be a lot smarter about. We're learning all the time on how you accelerate that self-sufficiency. But help is aimed in that direction, and we see so many examples where that's worked.
In terms of sustainable development and problems that emerge when you run into sort of cultural surprises in trying to help poor countries, what sorts of lessons have you learned in making sure that aid is customized to the individual recipients and the communities that are going to need to use it?
Well, I think that's a really important issue, which is when you're on the ground, it has to be very culturally sensitive because you're coming into people's lives as they already exist. And I'll give you a great example in the area of population, which is in Niger. It really is the men who have control over the women. There's a very high desired number of children by men and women, but it's really the man that decides whether his wife gets to use contraceptives, unless he's away and she can go do it covertly. So the way that the work is being done in that country is to do a husband's school, which is to first educate husbands about the fact that if you have fewer children and they stay alive, you have a better chance of keeping them nourished and keeping them educated. So by going to the husbands first, they begin to open up and say, wow, that might be acceptable for me to choose to do it in my family. In India, you go to the mother-in-law first because she's often more in control of the household. So you design programs based on what's right in a particular country.
Let's take the Ethiopia example for a moment. What worked there? Can you describe to me the chain of communication? Who did you go to first to try to get change filtered into various institutions that would really carry things forward? Because it's important to get the sequence right.
Yeah, in Ethiopia's case, they had a great health minister, Tedros, who got the donors working together and built measurement systems. In the case of their agriculture work, it was really Meles, the leader, who realized he was unhappy with what was going on. And in a meeting with Melinda, encouraged us to come in and do an assessment and actually built a whole new agency called the Agricultural Transformation Agency that oversaw the new policies. He actually took one of the foundation's best people to run that activity, and it was done tops down to create it. He's gone now, but fortunately that institution has been strong enough that it's continuing to grow and do great work.
And when you're on the ground traveling these countries, you know, Bill and I have been going to Tanzania for over a decade now, Ethiopia over a decade, where we go multiple times on trips. And when you go out in the rural areas and talk to farmers in Tanzania who are starting to get new seeds and they're seeing three times the yield on their farm, life for them is getting better. They'll show you the corrugated roof they have. They'll show you where their kids are now able to go to school. They'll show you how they can pay the school fees. So in tangible ways, those families are actually seeing progress. And when you go into Tanzania, into even a place like Arusha, you can see the economic progress that's happening there.
All right, the final question. To get what you need done in these places, do you sometimes have to work with unsavory characters? Do you have to look the other way on human rights issues in certain governments and just allow things to proceed domestically and focus on the ground level success that you want to achieve?
Well, certainly we're working with all kinds of governments. And if you had to agree with all of their policies, you wouldn't be in Africa. Who knows whether you could even work in the United States if you had that kind of view. We do know that as you get health and education, that these issues of equity, how women are treated, how gays are treated, those improve quite a bit. So no, they things that the U.S. has just come around on in the last 20 years, you can't expect Africa to have come around on all those things as of today. But I think in the same way their health is going up, they'll proceed in the direction that fortunately this country has become more enlightened on.
Melinda, a final thought?
Yes, I would just say that you know, again, as we travel around Africa and you see families coming together, you see communities coming together to demand health services of their government. So I saw this recently when I was in Senegal. The community, these three villages had band together and said, we need a health post in our community. And in their collective power, they go to the government and they get a health post built. You see the change that has happened around the world when you get a growing, prosperous middle class in a country. And I think you'll start to get these rights for women and other people that are so needed.
Bill and Melinda Gates, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The John Hockenberry spoke to Bill and Melinda Gates earlier this week. Well, if you could send aid to any place in the world, what place would you choose?
Bill, I'm calling from Nebraska. I think foreign aid in the form of food or money does not do any good at all. The despots tend to sit on that, and the people never see it. That being said, I think that Central Africa could use a lot of help with infrastructure, irrigation, and education.
Give us your take at 8778-MYTAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.